Okay, so welcome everyone to Lesson 3, which is now, of course, Guiding Principle 3. And this one is called Manage Contagious Emotion, and it's following on from the reworked version of Lesson 2, Guiding Principle 2, Listen to Your Horse. So if you've not read the full version of that, then the new version of that, then we strongly suggest you do before you get on to this one. And Linda is here to tell us all about why they should and how it's going to work in this lesson.
Thanks, Mark. One of the things that I was able to do in the revised version of Guiding Principle 2, Listen to Your Horse, which is pretty much the more or less the way it's going to look in the book, Power of the Herd, is to add some additional scientific research that kind of explains why you would want to use something we call the body scan. And so I just want to draw your attention to that, and you'll see it on the first page of Guiding Principle 2, but there's a book by the biologist Franz de Waal, and it's called The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. And he talks about what he calls the body-first theory, and this suggests that sometimes emotions arise from our bodies and are also transferred between people through the body first. And so most people believe that their emotions arise from thoughts and memories, and this is true sometimes, but sometimes what happens is because your body is a tuner and receiver and amplifier for all kinds of nonverbal information, information coming from other people and from the environment comes through your body first. And so if you start paying attention to your body as well as the thoughts and conversation that's kind of going along on the surface of things, you have a lot more information to do what we're advised to do, really, is that quote by Daniel Goleman in the book Primal Leadership, drive the emotions of others in the right direction to have a positive impact on earning or strategy. This is really what they're asking leaders to do now, is not to just notice what emotions people are feeling. Or previously, we had this idea that we were just supposed to suppress emotion because it was at odds with logic and wreaked havoc in the workplace. Now they're saying not just notice emotions of others, but turn them around, drive them in the right direction for a positive impact on what you're doing. And so you can do a lot of this through your body first. And we're going to add in this lesson nonverbal body-oriented cues that can turn an emotional situation around, as well as using the emotional message chart and getting the messages behind emotions to get important information from that other 90% that may be useful in helping you, you or your team or your family, get back on track in the most productive direction possible.
Right. Okay. So are we saying it's literally 90%? Then of our emotions are caused by these outside influences, or?
No, I was actually referring to that statistic that during interpersonal interactions, only 10% of human communication is verbal. So the other 90%, the nonverbal communication that's going on, is actually picked up by the body first. And so if you're paying attention to your body as a tuner and receiver and amplifier, you finally get to play with a full deck. You finally get to engage the full 100% of what's happening in the room. And then you can use your body to turn around some of those nonverbal elements without even bringing them up into conversation, as you're also having a productive conversation.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether your emotions generally, as opposed to just the communication, gets affected to that kind of level. I guess it's hard to try and quantify and measure that sort of thing, isn't it, really?
I would hope that in the future people can start doing some studies on exactly what's going on. We're just now starting to have some studies showing the intelligence of the body just in the last 50 years or so. So I think now we can even get more and more specific. But one of the things that you'll see also in Guiding Principle 2 is just a reference to a book called Descartes' Error by Antonio Damasio. He's a neuroscientist who showed that brain injury patients who've lost contact with their emotional centers in the brain, while maintaining full reasoning powers, actually have trouble making the simplest decisions. They are literally impaired. And so he shows that René Descartes' error was that your emotions are essential to intelligence, that rational decision-making is informed by emotion. And I think you've brought up in the past, Mark, some studies that you've used that show that in terms of sales, people usually make emotional decisions and then justify them with logic later. Is that right?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that's what the sales gurus tell you. And so that being the case, one can then understand that if one's emotional part of the brain is damaged, then how can you make your decisions? You can't really just make them on logic. I mean, it seems like you could, but actually what you're saying is, or what the guy said in the book, is that you can't, the neurosurgeon said.
It really is interesting to actually read that book and that section, because he shows how a person with a damaged brain in that way, where his rational thinking is cut off from his emotional brain, there was a guy who was like having trouble making the simplest decisions and would write out these long logical syllogisms almost and still not be able to decide because there would be too many options. And he needed that intuitive emotional take to inform his decision. So even deciding whether to drive or take a bus was a major dilemma for him.
It just goes to show then how much we are driven by emotions per se, generally speaking.
Yeah.
You know, we think we make good, sensible decisions, but actually we're all blowing in the wind of emotion, aren't we?
Right. But actually, what this is also showing is that emotion helps you to make good, sensible decisions. So sometimes we make emotional decisions based on things we're not aware of. Gut-level reactions to traumas of the past, for instance, can blow emotional intelligence out the door and just put you in a kind of traumatic emotional state where you make decisions based on thinking that everyone's threatening you, when in fact they may not be. I think we're going to touch on that a little bit later in this course. But for the most part, if emotion is functioning well, it actually does help you make good, sensible decisions.
It's probably a combination of the two, isn't it? Emotion and then, you know, logic and all backing each other up, both backing
right.
each other up. Yeah. Okay, so on to what else? Yes, you wanted to mention something about orchestras, didn't you?
Yes. You know, we're talking here about a leader, and anybody who does this, whether you're the official leader or not, if you can manage contagious emotions in a group and turn them around in a more productive direction, you will be seen as a leader in that situation, whether you're the boss, the official boss or not. So this, in a way, is a way of taking on a leadership role regardless of what your position is. And it's a productive leadership role, and people will come to and look to you for leadership. This is not about, you know, taking over your boss's job. This is about simply being a leader in a group situation where the outcome is just your goodwill toward everybody on the team working together well. And one of the most productive things you can do that's contagious is to simply be interested in what's happening emotionally in the group. And because a lot of times people, if certain emotions come up, or even if they're kind of hidden underneath with a feeling of tension or people being interested or not, or being agitated or not, even if it's not brought up, the unproductive, contagious thing to do is to act like this is a whole bunch of additional trouble and that anybody who's having a negative emotion is a problem for the group, just being agitated with emotion. And that's contagious. And in an unproductive direction. So the first thing you can do to turn emotions in a more productive way in a group is to simply follow this simple metaphor, which is, you know, if you were to pay $50, Mark, to go to a symphony concert, and you have marvelous symphonies in England as well as Germany, so you have a lot of opportunities for that. Would you pay $50 to hear someone, an entire group of people, play one long, beautiful, peaceful major chord all evening?
Not just one chord, no. That might be a little bit dull.
What do you pay for when you go to an orchestra concert? What do you want?
I think you want to, depending on what sort of piece it is, you want to really hear a range of different colours, I suppose, if I can use that terminology. You're looking to go through their kind of repertoire, their kind of, when I mean the tone and the color of the music and the and the speed and the tempo. And I'm trying to say all of this without using the word emotion.
Yeah, you can use the word emotion. Try it. See what
yeah.
happens.
Well, it is. You want to be stirred. You want to be, I want to be stirred. I want to be at the same time feel a romantic mood. I want to feel, you know, aroused. I don't mean sexually. I want to feel excited. I want to feel calm. And those are the kind of sensations and, yes, emotions that you generally don't get from anything other than sort of classical orchestral music. Yeah. So does that answer your question?
Well, I think it's heading down a track that I'm proposing here is that if you invest in going to a symphony concert, you are expecting a full range of emotions, and you're expecting to be touched deeply, not just by, you know, happy feelings or excited feelings or a, you know, happy little sprightly third movement. For me, I really want the minor key, deep longing, perhaps sad second movement too, you know, and I want this big, brassy, triumphant ending after a feeling of chaos at times even. That's the payoff for me, is to be taken through all of these different emotions and getting to an end that has an amazing resolution to it.
Yeah, well, of course, you have a great deal more experience about working in orchestras and working in those kind of arenas than I do. So, but yes, I can exactly see what you mean.
So if we go to a meeting with a group of people and we're willing to just have the mindset of, okay, what kind of symphony is going to happen today? And I'm going to appreciate whatever's happening. You know, if it's all happy and empowered and people are telling jokes and it's a little sprightly feeling here, that's great. But if, you know, someone's sad or someone's afraid or whatever, if I just see it as the symphony, recognizing too that in a group, just like in a symphony, these different emotions will change. They will transform, especially if we're present with them. So I think one of the best things you can do, and I sort of end this particular lesson with that idea, is appreciate the symphony, and you'll be ahead of the game, and you'll also be influencing others with your comfort with whatever's happening.
Right. So does that kind of mean that you're being accommodating to those who are being awkward? But I guess there might be a temptation to think, well, he or she's always a pain in the backside and they're always moaning about something, or and therefore you a boss, someone who's supposed to be a leader, might be in the situation where they think they might be mollycoddling them if they were to sort of pander to their you know, their wild emotions back and forth all the time.
What word did you use? Mollycoddling?
I wondered whether you'd be familiar with that word.
Say that again.
Mollycoddle.
Oh, what is the definition of that?
I have no idea.
Well, you know, what is the inference?
Well, I see what you mean. It means to sort of mother them.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, the idea is that, you know, with these different protocols in the Manage Contagious Emotions Guiding Principle 3, is that you're not just going to be a person in the audience, as it turns out. You're actually going to be the conductor, ultimately. So Manage Contagious Emotions takes this from a level of sitting in the audience and seeing all of this happen and being appreciative of it or engaged with it, to literally being the conductor. And so all of these steps that we're going through will allow you to get to that level. So you don't have to mollycoddle anybody. You have to just appreciate that that's part of the symphony they're playing today, and you're going to see what you can do to conduct it and herd it into a more productive direction.
And of course, you do realize if I see the word mollycoddle in the finished book, I will want a credit for that.
Yes,
by the way,
absolutely.
Just thought I'd mention that. All right. So tell me how I can be the conductor then.
Okay. Well, the first thing you want to do is employ the body scan before you enter any kind of a meeting with other people. That includes your family, a family reunion, a business meeting, a community activism group that's meeting, whatever. And the way to engage the body scan and how you do it and why you do it is really fleshed out in Guiding Principle 2. So I'm not going to really go over that again here. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing you want to do is notice others' vocal tone and body language in addition to their words. So that means you can't work on your grocery list while you're in a meeting, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it.
So here's just a simple way to start to get things going. This really makes a lot of sense to people. It seems very straightforward, but it's amazing how often this doesn't get done. So let's say you're working with a team and you're delegating a number of tasks working towards some kind of a goal. And what I do is I go through each task and then I ask individual team members for any suggestion they might have about that task or who would be the best person for it. But what I'm really looking for is as they speak about that task, who's the most enthusiastic about that task? And generally, when all is even, I assign that task to the person who's most enthusiastic. Now, there are some tasks that aren't really that exciting for anybody to get excited about. So then I look for who's most comfortable. Who is the least troubled by handling this task? Then I would go with them because enthusiasm and comfort are going to be contagious to the group. And that's what I want to emphasize. And then I start to notice is who's apathetic or agitated when they talk about a certain task. And maybe that is their job and maybe there's no getting around it. And so then I really want to begin to use emotions as information to find out what it is that irritates them about that particular task. Because their apathy or agitation is going to be contagious too, and it might actually cause them to drop the ball on that task. If they just keep putting it off, it's going to affect the team in the long run. And so I'm going to start to find out what it is about that task. Do they need more training and they're afraid to admit it? Do they not really understand the task to begin with? They need more clarity. Or maybe they actually need help. They don't need to be doing this alone. Maybe they're just simply overworked, underpaid, or underrecognized, or simply bored with their current job. And I need to know that too, because that's going to affect the entire team in the long run. So I just, rather than mollycoddling somebody, I'm going to be interested in why it is they're agitated and try to get to the root of that. And it may be appropriate to do in the meeting itself, or it may be something that I can see they're a little bit nervous about and discussing with the whole group. I may pull them aside and talk about it in a private meeting and make sure that the information is kept confidential so that they feel confident in letting me know what's really going on.
Yeah, because I guess there is a difference between a general attitude or issue that's going on with them and something that's specific to that meeting, to that task. Or maybe it's just, something's happened at home and you want to be conscious of that sort of thing.
Right. And there is a combination you'll see in this sequence of what we bring up in a group meeting and then what we pull aside for a private meeting.
Right.
Because there are certainly some things that people shouldn't be talking about in a group meeting. And we don't want to turn a business meeting into an encounter group. So we just notice what's affecting the current group in getting the task done. And then anything that's off to the side that's private perhaps, or maybe even an interpersonal problem between two staff members, that's probably something to be brought up outside the meeting. But you're still taking notes of it and you're still going to work on it so that it doesn't throw a wrench into getting the task done overall.
Yeah, and you can begin to see how this would work in practice because one normally just ignores all that other nonsense. And that's how it's seen. It's other nonsense. What's said
right,
is said, and
exactly.
What's it's black and white, and it's done. Whereas, in fact, if you're starting to pay attention to what is going on, if someone's rolling their eyes or breathing out
right,
and looking thoroughly dejected, sound like a horse, then these are signs that there's something going on with this person.
Exactly. And it's going to affect the entire group. You may call it nonsense, but that nonsense is going to be a problem sooner or later. So you might as well deal with it now in its earliest, least objectionable stage.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And of course, that sort of energy goes out, doesn't it? When someone is really feeling depressed or is really being annoying, that does affect other people very dramatically.
It really does. And it drags the whole team down. It's a huge waste of energy. And yet nobody knows what the problem is. It just steadily drags everybody down to a place where you know, they aren't working as efficiently, and it affects the bottom line. It affects how much money you make and how much money you spend. So if for no other reason than that, this is what you want to deal with. So,
okay. So how do we, as the leader of the orchestra, as the leader of the meeting, say, how does one then decide, or in which cases do you decide to handle something outside of the meeting, and which things can be handled within the meeting? Can you maybe give us some examples of that?
Sure. Ultimately, a lot of things can be handled in the meeting with a group that's trained in these same emotional intelligence skills. So the more people you have that are trained to manage contagious emotion and use emotions as information, the more it gets handled in the meeting, and the more it actually, they handle it before they even bring it to the meeting. So it just gets more and more and more efficient. But if you're walking into a group of people who know none of these skills, and in the beginning, that's what you're facing, is that you're the one who knows these skills and nobody else does. Then you start to follow the sequence. And so I think it's good to get to step three here. Before you explore the messages behind others' emotions, the first thing you need to do is resolve to sit in uncomfortable emotions without panicking. Okay, so rather than feeling agitated or feeling like this is nonsense, or, you know, trying to gloss it over and move forward, or, you know, feeling like you need to smoke really quickly, or that you're going to eat an entire chocolate cake when you get home, whatever it is, you need to exercise your ability to sit in uncomfortable emotions without panicking. And so this is kind of like isometric exercise for your emotional muscles. And you will get stronger over time the more you do this. Isometric exercise is where you hold a 50-pound weight without doing reps. Okay, isometric is where you hold something heavy. The longer you can hold that emotional weight, that emotional heaviness without panicking, the better you get at thinking clearly in the midst of those emotions and asking the questions of the that are listed on the emotional message chart and noticing the group dynamics that are giving rise to those emotions. If you panic in response to uncomfortable emotions, you're not going to notice the dynamics of what's happening, and you're not going to be able to problem solve. Here's the thing, is that if you can do this, it in itself is contagious. The ability to sit in uncomfortable emotions without that panicking, creating a thoughtful, problem-solving approach to what's going on, that is contagious in a positive way.
It sounds like Washington, right?
Exactly. It's like George Washington standing on that, sitting on that horse, standing on that bridge when all those people are being shot at. So
that's just what I was thinking of, yeah.
Exactly. That's the epitome of sitting in uncomfortable emotions without panicking.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, in just about anything that's going on in a meeting, if there's an uncomfortable emotions rising, if you think of George Washington sitting on his horse in that level of panic and calming people around him down, then you just realize that whatever you're facing is nothing compared to that, and you can just get on with your day.
Yeah, stop moaning about it. Get on with it.
Right, right.
Okay, what's next?
Okay, so the next thing is, if you can do number three, then you can do number four. So when some kind of emotionally charged situation arises, just pull up on your computer the emotional message chart. And this will help jumpstart your own problem-solving mindset. So I'm going to actually, with this lesson, include an abbreviated chart that just has the emotions without the commentary, so you can quickly look at the questions and what the emotions mean. And so you can just pull that up and start looking at it. And if you see somebody who's acting a little bit agitated and you can't tell if he's angry or frustrated or reacting to something else, just look at the questions and the emotional messages behind anger and frustration and start to look at the situation and see which one seems to be relevant. And sometimes you personally can't tell, so then you're going to have to ask the questions, and we'll get to that in a minute. Another thing that you can do that you really should do, and this will save everybody a lot of time and trouble, is number five, you take care of your own body first. You feel this tension rising in the group, and you notice where it's located in your body. So if you're sitting in a group, Mark, and people start to roll their eyes and look agitated and speak shortly to each other and maybe make some cynical remarks, what happens to your body?
you get kind of tense normally, or you start to get angry, depending on where your position is in that group or what your responsibility is.
Right. You probably start to rise. You might feel some tension in your gut, and you probably start holding your breath. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can happen.
These things are all contagious too. They're nonverbal cues that are contagious. And you can turn that around in a group by breathing into your own body's tension first. If you start breathing into the tension in your body, whether or not you can get a message or not, because sometimes in a group situation, there's too much chaos, there's too much input to get a message right away. But the first thing you can do is breathe into the tension. And that will relax your body slightly, and it will cause everybody else to start breathing more too. And when people can breathe, they can become more thoughtful, and they're less likely to escalate this sense of panic and irritation.
Right, because in NLP, they talk about matching and mirroring and getting in sync with someone's breathing, and then they start to sort of feel more comfortable. And I guess that it's the kind of the same thing but opposite, whereby you're setting the pace. So you're, in NLP, I think it's called leading, isn't it? And so you're leading and setting the pace there.
Right.
And just calming it down, and people then just automatically kind of just fall into your rhythm, especially if it's a good rhythm, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And, one person who's interested in what's happening as opposed to repulsed by what happens, that person breathing into the tension in their own body and starting breathing deeply can turn an entire group around. It's really quite amazing, because the reason I learned how to do this is because I had to work with a really agitated, threatening stallion. And he weighed 1,000 pounds and he was very scary. And if I held my breath, he got worse. But if I breathed, he would start to calm down and become more thoughtful. And so I have a lot of confidence with this, because if I could take a 1,000-pound scary animal coming at me, start to breathe and turn his attitude around, I know I can do it with, maybe 100, maybe 1,000 people at once.
Right. So QED, obviously the horses are picking the stallion picked up on your breathing and felt that from you, and of course they do it on a much more enhanced level than we do, but I guess we humans do the same thing as well.
Yes, we do. And, you can also just have some fun. You can go into a meeting and not do any of these things and just watch what happens to your body and everybody else's body. And just go ahead and hold your breath when everybody else is and see what happens. It's not very pleasant, but it's an interesting exercise.
No, but that's a good point, because if you're, again, going in without doing any of these things, but then deliberately going in and not doing them, but noticing the effects on your body, then you can begin to see, this stuff, it does work in a negative way, so let's start to use it in a positive way. So I think that's a really good suggestion, actually, to just be aware of what's happening to you and the effects that these emotions and tensions and frustrations and angers are all having on you and your body.
And here's the ironic thing, Mark, is that if you go into a meeting with the idea that you're just going to notice what happens, whatever's happening, and the effect on your body without trying to turn it around, your interest in what's happening is going to have a positive effect on everybody.
Okay. It's that whole thing about just by being aware of it, right?
Exactly. By being aware and interested. Wow, how does this affect my body? How is this person's shoulders rising? Ooh, look at their voice getting really wavery, But the feeling that you're sitting there going, ooh, look at that, as opposed to, oh, I can't stand this, turns the whole thing around for everybody too. It's really starts to work on people.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
So we've done steps 1 through 5. So now you're ready to begin assessing and managing others' emotions. And so I often recommend, first of all, is number 6, to just notice if there are any incongruent people in the group. And an incongruent person is someone who's smiling and saying she's fine with body language that suggests something else. So someone smiling and saying they're fine, or acting like they're in control with the body language and breathing of somebody perhaps who's afraid, or somebody whose tears are welling up in their eyes, or, you're looking for the nonverbal signals, a clenched jaw, sarcastic remarks as a dead giveaway, reluctance to make eye contact, that's pretty significant, exaggerated sighing, as you did earlier, Mark. Exactly. Red or watery eyes. And then sometimes a person's pretty subtle about hiding it, but you can still get a kind of gut feeling that someone's preoccupied or hiding something. And so this person is incongruent. But you don't want to automatically assume that an incongruent person is untrustworthy, because it may be a personal situation at home and no one's business, and they're just trying to function in a meeting and not cause a problem for anybody. But we saw with some of the research earlier that an incongruent person in a group, not only does their blood pressure rise when they're trying to suppress an emotion, but it causes the blood pressure of everybody else in the group to rise. And so you want to just pay attention to those little factors.
Right.
And then,
and
go ahead.
No, I didn't want to butt in there because I knew you were gonna, I knew you wanted to continue. I didn't want to get ahead of you in your list of things. So you go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that over time, you can create an atmosphere of professional trust and support on a team where people can acknowledge that they're experiencing personal difficulties without sharing the details. Okay, so the way this works is Jennifer walks in to a room and, you know, she's agitated and has a personal problem and she's trying to hide it because it's not appropriate to share. And she doesn't want anybody to know about it. And so she's incongruent in a meeting and everybody else's blood pressure rising. And then there are other people in the meeting watching her and even unconsciously thinking that she's agitated with them and not talking about it. So then maybe they get defensive or maybe they get irritated with her. And a lot of this happens unconsciously in groups.
Right.
However, if Ginny walks in and she says, "Hey guys, I just want to let you know that I'm not working at 100% today. I just found out something in my personal life that is causing me some irritation. I'm handling it. It's not going to be worked out today, but I just want to let you know that I'm a little off." And if she says that, she hasn't told you that she just found out that her husband's having an affair, but she's walked in and she's said, I'm agitated today. Basically, she's saying, it doesn't have anything to do with any of you. So nobody has to spend any time or energy trying to figure out why she's irritated. They just know it's something outside of work. She says she's handling it. She's not at 100% today, so let's just move forward.
Right. So I guess there has to be a level of trust going on here, because otherwise, it could be open to abuse within that sort of environment.
And that's why you don't ever pry for the details in a work environment. You know,
right.
And you don't share the details in a work environment. So, you know, really, people learn how to say that they are affected by a personal situation without saying what the personal situation is. And generally, there's nothing but a positive response to that. So in some ways, you can start modeling this in groups with people. You could say, "Hey, I just learned this really interesting thing about emotional intelligence that shows that people who are incongruent in a group not only cause their blood pressure to rise, but cause the blood pressure of everyone else in the group to rise. And because of that, then clear thinking is interrupted." And quite often people feel what's going on and they think that there's something going on in the group when there's not. So from now on, I'm just going to let you know if something's going on with me personally so that you don't have to worry about it. So I want to tell you today that I'm not working at 100%. I just found out something in my personal life that is quite disturbing to me at this moment. I'm working on it outside of work. I'm not going to let it affect my work, but I want you to know that I am agitated and it has nothing to do with you guys. And then everybody just kind of sighs and everybody gets back on task.
Yeah, and that's not so different from a personal relationship between husband and wife, for example, where he's, you know, cheesed off because something's happened at work or something's happened, I don't know, at sports or something like that. And he's home in a bad mood and she thinks, oh, it's something that she's done. But in fact, and that can lead to problems. Whereas in fact, if he could just tell her, or, you know, they would have a sensible conversation about it and he explains, then she knows she's off the hook and she's got nothing to worry about.
Right. And that's something you want to do at home as well, is just to walk in the door and say, "I've had a hard day. Someone's really, really upset me at work. I don't really want it to affect our evening, but I just want you to know that that's the state I'm walking in with. And then maybe she fixes you something special for dinner as a result. So it's always to your benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's too often that stuff, you do try and hide it, and I've been guilty of that myself. And then the other person gets a little bit paranoid. Like, is it me? What did I do?
Right, and what a waste of time and energy.
Yeah.
To be worried about what you did wrong when you didn't do anything wrong. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, enough said.
Okay, so now we move on to number 7. Basically, sometimes incongruent people at work are experiencing interpersonal difficulties with another team member. Okay, so if that incongruent person walks in and doesn't say, I have something going on at home, I'm not working at 100%, they just sit down and they're trying to be calm, but you can tell they're incongruent, then start to see if maybe it's actually something interpersonal in the group, which they probably aren't quite aware of yet, or they just don't feel comfortable bringing up in the group because they don't want to shame their coworker, for instance. So there's often a very good reason for not bringing that up in a group. So you just kind of watch. If Jane purses her lips or rolls her eyes or looks out the window whenever Jim speaks, then you're probably witnessing evidence of interpersonal difficulties between them. And so long term, these difficulties can poison any group interaction, really mess things up, even if it all stays below the surface, because people get cynical, they don't trust each other, they get more and more agitated with each other, and that becomes contagious to the group. And it keeps people from thinking clearly and staying on task, let alone thinking creatively. So if you see this going on and you happen to be the actual leader of the group, you can pull those two aside and you can get them some coaching and some support in working out their interpersonal difficulty. But do it outside the meeting, because probably the reason why Jane is hiding this, she doesn't know how to bring it up to Jim. She doesn't have the skills for it. And yet there are skills for this, and it's actually Guiding Principle 9, preparing for difficult conversations. So this is a more advanced technique later. But in the meantime, if you notice that the irritation is directed toward a particular person, then at least you don't have to worry about whether it's you or not, right?
Right. And we've all witnessed this, I'm sure, if not be a work environment or a church environment or a club environment, where there's a situation where two people are at each other's throats, not literally, but verbally, and you just switch off at that point. So it kind of ruins your input into the meeting and your concentration and your creativity and your energy and enthusiasm. It's just like, oh, gee, there's Jane and Bill again, or Jane and Jim, whoever they were, going at it. And right. You just switch off until they've finished.
Right. And sometimes they don't even go at it. They're just like, they just won't look at each other, and they won't support each other in a real team building kind of way. You know, both are equally destructive. The subtle one, where they're not looking at each other and not helping each other and being sarcastic with each other, is more destructive over time. The going at each other in a meeting just blasts the entire meeting. Everybody's circuits are blasted, and nobody can really get back on task that easily.
Yeah. So it's beholden upon you as the team leader or the manager to really deal with that outside of that meeting and make sure that situation gets resolved for the benefit of not just the two of them, but everyone else.
Absolutely. So we kind of move on to step 8 here. And basically, if you're in a situation that where there's some kind of a challenge and strong emotions are emerging, this is what you need to do. You don't want to brace against it. You don't want to gloss it over. You don't want to order people to shut up and get back on task, because that's just the situation is not going to be resolved, and it's just going to go underground and affect things at a covert level. What you really want to do is breathe, because that causes everybody else to breathe. And then you want to ask constructive, fact-finding, problem-solving questions. Okay? So you don't want to engage in a psychological encounter group approach to emotion. When you do this, John, I feel this. Don't ever use that in a business meeting. It is not just useless. It is actually, I've seen over time, to be absolutely destructive. Because what it does is it causes the person who's being it causes Jim, when you say, when you do this, that, Jim, I feel this, it causes Jim to feel shamed in the moment, put on the spot. And all of a sudden, it's almost like you're telling him that he's responsible for your emotions. Even though in a traditional encounter group, people are told that you're not responsible for others' emotions, when you use this statement, it implies that you are, whether you're saying you are or not. So don't use that ever. It's absolutely destructive. And I've even noticed in families, it's not very helpful either. What really works is to ask the questions, situation relevant questions behind the emotions that you're seeing. Okay, so so now we're sliding into number 9. And this is really about diffusing defensiveness in others. Just ask the questions associated with the moment, the emotion. Don't mention the emotions themselves, because emotions are information. So why even bother with that initial phase? So if somebody looks angry or frustrated, and in people, the body language of these emotions looks very much the same, don't ask Jim, are you angry or frustrated? Instead, again, ask situation-relevant questions based on the messages behind those emotions. So you might ask, you're not really sure whether he's angry or frustrated. So you're going to ask first, have we reached a block or an impasse in moving forward on this project? And if he just kind of looks at you and doesn't really think so, then you might ask, and here's where you have to feel vulnerable for a minute. Have I overstepped my role here, or have I been inconsiderate of your needs or your time or your professional expertise in some way? And maybe he lights up and says, yeah, you know, I thought it was my area to work on this aspect of the team. And all of a sudden you came in and took over. And this was something I was really looking forward to working on, you know? And so then, you know, he was angry because you overstepped a boundary with him.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. So you always do frustration, then anger?
Not necessarily. Sometimes you can tell right away what it is. And you just ask the question.
Yeah.
And so the sort of a deeper level of this is, and we talked about this in one of the chapters, it just came up. But when somebody looks particularly agitated or fragile in a group, especially in a group meeting, what you do is you ask relevant questions to others around him or her first, because it's they're too agitated or too fragile to just start speaking. But if you get a discussion going that's on the topic that concerns them, then they can start to feel comfortable enough to contribute. So if you have a colleague that looks afraid or vulnerable as you're moving forward with a project, the last thing you want to say is, Mary, you look a little peaked today. Are you afraid or vulnerable? I mean, that would just that would just shut the whole thing down for her.
Yeah.
Instead, what you're going to do is you're going to ask the group to discuss issues related to those emotions. Fear, which is some kind of legitimate safety concern. And then vulnerability feels like fear, but you're not in any external danger here. You're in a situation where you need more information or training, or sometimes people feel just sheer panic when you have to move out of a comfortable habit and try something new. So if you're creating a new method or a new way of interacting or some kind of putting some kind of new policy into force, sometimes people will look really scared and panicky. It's just vulnerability. They just have to try something new and step out of their comfort zone. So you don't want to say, Mary, you look like you don't like stepping out of your comfort zone here, because that creates defensiveness. Instead, what you're going to do is you're going to say, okay, before we move forward with this plan, let's consider issues related to safety of the project, the product, or maybe safety of the company in general. Maybe there's someone out there who's going to come after us for some reason or another. These are safety issues. But also, I want to look at what elements do we need to address here involving more information or better preparation and training. So, John, do you have any concerns or ideas here? And then you ask somebody else, what about you, Sally? Do you have any concerns here? Mary, do you have any concerns? And so this discussion's already been going, and Mary's perhaps the third person you ask, or maybe Mary jumps forward immediately and starts talking, but she does it because she wasn't put on the spot.
Yeah, it's a bit like being back in school, isn't it? You never want to be the first kid that's asked to answer the question. But if several others have done it before you, then it's okay.
Yeah. And I mean, these are like simple things that are very rarely done.
Yeah, it just takes a little bit of sensitivity and common sense.
Exactly. So yeah. here's another thing you want to pay attention to is avoid using any kind of inflammatory words and gestures, because this is perhaps the worst form of emotional contagion you can get going. Inflammatory words and gestures create wildfires of negative emotional contagion. They'll send some people into an outright flight or fight mode, and they generally make everyone else defensive or uncomfortable on some level. So inflammatory statements include, "I felt betrayed," or "you should be ashamed of yourself," or "you really dropped the ball on this one," or "I'm very disappointed in all of you." And here's one that really, really sets people off. No, but here's two of them. If you say the word, "you violated my boundaries," if you word use the phrase, "violated my boundaries," that's an inflammatory phrase. Even though anger is about setting boundaries, you don't want to use that phrase. You want to say instead, "you know, I really felt like this was my part of the project, and I felt like you stepped in before I asked you for help. And while I would like your help, you know, I just really want to move forward on this myself because I have some good ideas." You don't want to say, "you violated my boundaries by stepping in before I asked." That's inflammatory, and it makes someone defensive, and it shuts everyone down.
Yeah.
Another one, the other one you don't ever want to say, although you want to use it as information yourself, is to say, "I don't feel safe in the group." That may be true, but when you're in a leadership position especially, it's not everyone else's job to make you feel safe in the group. Okay, that's really for you to assess what is the threat here in the group and how can I move to a position of safety. And sometimes as a leader, your job is to be like George Washington. Your job is to get in there and be the one who's brave in stepping forward first and troubleshooting. It's not your team member's job to make you feel safe in the group. You know, you need to troubleshoot. What is the threat here? What do we need to do to move to a position of safety? Is this person coming after me because they're trying to get my job? Okay, I need to assess that. I need to find out who that is, and I need to perhaps have a personal discussion with them, make them feel more like a team member. And if they continue to undermine me, maybe I need to let them go. It's not the rest of the group's job to make me feel safe.
No, no. And in your experience, because I know you've coached in companies, have you been involved? I mean, have you witnessed sort of live situations in boardrooms or in team meetings where this kind of thing is going on?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, in the corporate world, you don't usually hear, "I don't feel safe in the group." That's usually a group that's more, perhaps a community group or a social activism group or a group of people that are engaging in some kind of community building in some way or another. Perhaps in a religious organization, you might hear that. Usually the kinds of things you hear in the corporate world are, "I'm very disappointed in all of you." And or some kind of shaming remark, you know, "you really dropped the ball on this one, Fred." That sort of thing.
Yeah. And of course, along with that goes all the slamming of fist on the table and "you sheriff," you know, whatever. And you know, things like you just mentioned with some blue language mixed in with it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure there's a lot of that goes on.
Yes, I've heard a lot of blue language.
Yeah. And, you know, that whole slamming on the fists on tables, and that can't be helpful either by the same token, really.
Right. And see, here's the thing is, the thing you need to do too is to turn an emotional trend around in a group before it gets started. You need to refrain from reacting defensively to inflammatory words or gestures directed at you. Okay. So if somebody says to you, "Linda," you know, or "Mark," let's say to you, "Mark, Mark, okay, you really dropped the ball on this one." You need to not get defensive at that moment and start that whole negative trend rolling along. You need to take the high road on this one. So then you're going to need to find out, you don't like the way they said it, but there's information there. They perceive that you let something go that you should have done. So you need to then begin to ask thoughtful problem-solving questions. Okay, which ball are we talking about here that I dropped? Let me know. You know, what did I let fall through the cracks? Maybe you want to even diffuse the negativity by not using their language, by not mirroring their language back, like the NLP thing. Maybe instead you need to diffuse their language. So rather than saying, "Oh, what ball did I drop?" you might say, "What aspect of the plan did it seem to fall in through the cracks on my watch?" You know, and for some reason that just diffuses it for everybody.
Yeah, that's a good technique.
Yeah. So, so it's both. Don't use inflammatory words and gestures, but don't respond defensively to them either. And that means you have to be willing to take. You know, it's like somebody's punching you in the belly a little bit. But you need to take it and then turn it around and use it as information.
Well, it goes back to that phrase we used the other day, which is emotional heroism, wasn't it? Wasn't that the phrase we used?
Absolutely. I think this is a great example of when you need to employ emotional heroism. To, you know, take a few hits in the gut with a frantic person and then turn it around in a productive direction. And all of a sudden, you are seen as a much more thoughtful, trustworthy leader than the person who would punch and hit back. Really. I mean, it just raises your reputation right there on the spot.
Yeah. And it kind of, I'm reminded of Churchill during World War II. And from what little I know, he was always a very calm influence. I mean, his words were very emotional and stirring in some of his speeches, but he seemed to be a calming presence, is my impression. And of course, I've not got much to go on, really. And I'm sure that helped hugely.
Yeah, it did. He did have the ability to calm large groups of people down. I've heard some reports that maybe in interpersonal behind-the-scenes interactions, he wasn't always so calming. But I think that the more you can do this throughout your life, whether it's in front of large groups of people or it's with your own private staff or your own family members, the more you can take a few punches from somebody who's using inflammatory words or gestures and then turn it around to get information from it, the smoother everything in your life is going to run and the more people will seek you out for leadership.
Yeah, and actually to go along with that, I don't know whether you heard, you know, the King's Speech, the movie from a year or so ago
with Colin Firth. Yes, yeah. I saw that.
And apparently his speeches during the war had a similar calming effect on Britain, and it was because he was speaking very slowly because he had the problem in talking. And because of his slow, deliberate delivery, it actually had a calming effect.
Yes, and that's one of those examples of, if you go back to Guiding Principle 2 and read that discussion there, they show that, you know, not only do emotions affect body postures and tone of voice, your tone of voice and body postures can literally turn your emotions around. So that would be an example of somebody whose tone over the radio is coming out for a reason that's unrelated to calmness, but it has a calming effect.
Yeah. Cool. Very good.
So now we're at a number 11 here. And so this is more or less what we were just talking about, is if you can meet aggressive acts with a thoughtful, problem-solving attitude and read others' misbehavior as a form of communication, people are going to seek your leadership in the future especially. You're not going to just turn a negative trend around in the moment. People are going to literally seek your leadership. So this includes passive-aggressive acts. These are the ones that I find the most infuriating. I'd almost rather have somebody shout at me openly in a meeting than to be quiet and smile and say yes, that they're on my side, and undermine me behind my back. I've had it happen a lot of times. But, you know, for me to get mad at that in the same way I would get mad at misbehavior in a group is also creating a negative trend. What I realize is that people who engage in passive-aggressive acts, they actually have never really learned how to use power effectively. They're really trying to conform, but they just can't take it for very long. And then they start to, you know, gossip or undermine you behind their back because they don't know how to use their power effectively and they don't know how to communicate their needs effectively. So if you can see that happening, and it takes a while for that one to be seen, turn that around too, then you know, they will seek out your leadership.
So how do you do that then? How do you turn someone around who's got that, who's obviously got some issues about their lack of, I don't know, self-confidence or self-esteem or self-belief or something?
Well, generally those people, this is the tactic that we have learned as slaves and serfs over the last 5,000 years, passive-aggressive acts. You know, and so it's just a person who doesn't know how to use their power, and they don't have the emotional and social intelligence skills to get their needs met. And maybe when they asked as a child for their needs to be met, they were severely abused because of it. So they even have fear of doing that. So generally, I just deal with the situation. So by the time I find out that there's been a passive-aggressive act, where people, someone has been nice to my face but talking about me behind my back, usually by that time I've heard what it is they're saying. And so then I just address that in a productive way in the same way I would if somebody shouted at me in a meeting.
Right. Okay.
So basically I say here, if you take the high road and turn a negative trend around, others will seek your leadership in the future. And so that, you know, you can have a purely self-serving agenda here if you want. You can just say, hey, I want to be seen as the leader. I'm going to turn negative trends around. People are going to seek my leadership out. But at the same time, the only reason they seek your leadership is if you've served them well. So it actually maybe takes a selfish concept. I want others to choose me as the leader. And it turns it around to serve the group anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also, here's another thing that you really want to pay attention to is, whenever possible, don't shame the aggressive, misbehaving person in front of the group. Discuss their inappropriate behavior privately after the meeting. And what you really want to do is offer the disruptive person some solutions for how to deal more constructively with the issue that caused the misbehavior if a similar situation arises in the future. And a simple way to think about this is, have you ever watched Star Trek: The Next Generation, Mark?
I'm afraid not, no. I'm not a big fan of the movies.
Okay. Well, Star Trek, this show, the Next Generation, had Captain Picard. And Captain Picard was a stellar example of this. He would do this all the time. If somebody acted up in front of the group, he would say, "All right, Mr. Data, I need to see you in my ready room." And then he would pull the aggressor aside and deal with the issue privately. He wouldn't say, "That's inappropriate what you did just now, and you need to change this in the future." And one that would constantly get out of control is the Klingon Mr. Worf, who was kind of this big, intense alien guy who had huge passions run amok. And so sometimes he would act up, and Picard would say, "Okay, Mr. Worf, I need to see you in my ready room." And then he would take him aside. He would talk to him about the inappropriate behavior and what he wanted to see done differently in the future. So, you know, this has just been, you know, depicted on a popular television show, and it's very rarely used in groups as far as I can see.
I didn't take you for a Star Wars fan, but there you go. Yeah, I learn something new every day.
Star Trek, yeah.
Star Trek.
I love Star Trek, I do. I'm not like a total geek about it, but I love Star Trek.
Why? That's a question for another day. Okay,
so we're at number 12 now. Here's where it continues to get trickier, and this is where you really take on, through becoming a leader or becoming a socially and emotionally intelligent follower, where this becomes an aspect of personal development. You need to start recognizing when you're triggered by past betrayals or difficulties or traumas, because it's actually obvious to others when you're overreacting to something minor, you know. So it's not like you're hiding anything at all by exploding over something minor. You just want to notice when you're doing it so that other people don't have to say, "Man, he really has a hair trigger response to that sort of thing. Wonder what happened in his past." Instead, do it for yourself. Recognize it for yourself. So if you get into a shouting match with somebody, or you seek revenge, or you undermine someone behind his or her back, these are things that could be seen as misbehavior in yourself, and usually they happen because you're triggered by something in the past. And so what you want to start to do is notice what belongs to the current situation and what belongs to the past. That's the first thing you do. You want to focus on the present in the meeting and at work, and then make an appointment to deal with the past with a coach or a counselor or a confidant, because unresolved issues will cloud your intuition. They're going to compromise your ability to think clearly, and they're going to affect the ability of the entire group to function whenever you overreact to something minor. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the old baggage thing, isn't it?
Right.
You leave your baggage at the door when you come in.
Right. And if you can't leave if your baggage all of a sudden shows up and plunges onto the table in the middle of a meeting, you know that you have some baggage to deal with, and you better get it resolved or it's going to happen again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if it keeps appearing magically, as you say, in the middle of the table, then it's a serious issue.
Yes, unpack that bag at home or with a counselor or a coach, you know. And so you don't get triggered in the future. So if everybody did that, the world would be a better place, wouldn't it?
Well, it would make life a lot simpler in a lot of many, many situations.
Right. So at the same time, you want to do the sort of the mirror image of this as a leader. You want to notice, and I'm talking about number 13 here, you want to notice when others are triggered, okay? And even when they seem to be hiding it relatively well, because most of the time when somebody's triggered, they can hide it pretty well. They aren't like exploding at somebody. They're actually having some kind of telltale sign that's a combination of some kind of disgusted, defeated, or cynical body language in combination with these sweeping generalization statements, like statements that often include always or never are really good keys into the fact that somebody's triggered right now. So somebody might say, management never listens to us, or I always get the short end of the stick. And maybe they're not screaming or raving. Maybe you're just trying to move forward and talking about how we're going to take our plan to management here. And somebody like sits back and their shoulders go down and they kind of sigh and they say, well, management never listens to us, in a really kind of quiet voice that almost nobody's paying attention to. And you can say, oh, okay. All right. So when he says management never listens to us, he's been in a situation where management has not listened to him several times on something he thought was important. That's the message behind that statement, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So you don't want to say, John, I heard you saying under your breath some sweeping generalization. You seem to be triggered by something. You would never say that.
Yeah, obviously, yes.
Okay, so again, you're going to use the verbal and nonverbal cues they've given to ask relevant work-related questions that encourages this person to differentiate between the past and the present, learning from the past to produce a different outcome in the present. So you're going to use a kind of a problem-solving thing here. And it's probably going to be to everybody's best interest in the case of management never listens. So you might say, John, I just heard you say that management never listens to us. So if it's really important for management to listen to us here, let's take a minute and let's look at what happened in the past. Let's explore the situations where management didn't listen, and let's take a look at what was our approach back then, you know? What was really at stake here? Maybe we didn't present it in a way that management could listen. And does anybody in this group have a situation where management did listen? Okay, tell me what your approach was. Oh, it's a totally different approach. Let's use that approach. So you see how you've sort of used their disgusted, cynical take on the past to problem solve to get somewhere more productive in the present.
Right. And I'm just wondering how effective that's going to be when, you know, you're faced with a management that doesn't really listen or doesn't appreciate. I mean, I see it from people around me, and you know, there's all kinds of lunacy. And of course, in larger organisations, it's even worse because there are levels and levels and levels of management. And so, some of the decisions coming down from on high, you know, are very, very difficult to deal with because one never then understands what the reasoning is behind them, and if there was any, and presumably there was. Do you see what I'm saying? It becomes a difficult situation.
Yes, and this is a problem sometimes. not as often as you might think, because a lot of times people are really, they've had multiple situations where management didn't listen to them. And so their actual behavior, expecting management not to listen from the past, causes management not to listen. So really by taking, you know, perhaps having a meeting on looking at, you know, instances when management didn't listen and what was the approach, both verbally and non-verbally. And then really asking, has anybody ever had a situation here where management listened? What was going on? What was the situation? Maybe getting some clues. And then if it turns out that management doesn't listen to anybody anytime, then you as the leader need to take that information to management and say, I don't see how you can expect us to get done what you're asking to get done when there's a block here in communication. That what we spend a large amount of time and money on in our team developing is turned down. This is costing you money up from a management point of view. What shall we do differently?
Right, because you have to bat for your team as well as batting for, you know, the chiefs and managers above you, right?
Right. And sometimes it is that the management isn't listening because the team is off in left field somewhere doing something they think is right without really seeing what really is what the management wants. I've seen that a number of times too. And as it turns out, if you're in a job where your creativity and your ideas are constantly at odds with what the management wants, you're either going to have to let go of what you want to do and give them what they want, or you need to leave. And, you know, you need to know that. You need to know what the story is to make that decision. Am I going to stay and give up what I want to do because I get a nice fat paycheck? Or am I going to leave and find a place where my ideas are more in sync with the management? But you have to troubleshoot about it, and you have to start looking at it, the intricacies first, before you can even make that decision.
Yeah. Okay.
So here's number 14 here is one that we're going to spend an entire guiding principle on, but you need to know this as you're managing contagious emotions. Don't ever, 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 ever use someone's vulnerability against him or her. And so a vulnerability is a lack of training or a skill deficiency or some kind of miscommunication or a mistake someone makes, or a fear they have, or some kind of past trauma they have, or some kind of interpersonal weakness they have. Don't use that against him or her. Because what happens if you do that is it's going to increase fear, mistrust, secretiveness, defensiveness, and aggressiveness in the entire group, especially over time. So you can turn an entire sequence of disastrous, diseased, negative emotions around by never using somebody's vulnerability against him or her, and also not rewarding others for using their colleagues, employees, or leaders' vulnerabilities against them.
Yeah, and you can see how that's going to spread paranoia, is perhaps too strong a word, but within the rest of the group, fear.
Right.
That if you're, you know, picking on someone or making them look small or look ridiculous, then clearly that's going to have a really negative effect on the rest of the team.
Right, and it undermines your position as a leader. You may think that you're using somebody's vulnerability to, in the moment, look like you know more than they do, but what it really causes is for everybody else not to want to tell you anything because you're going to make them look bad.
Yeah, and lose respect for you, yeah.
And, you know, in the same tone here, you don't tolerate gossip at work. You don't engage it, you don't spread it, and if somebody starts gossiping to you, you just say, well, it sounds like that's someone's personal life, or sounds like that's between those two colleagues to work out for themselves. I just want to, you know, encourage them to have the privacy they need to work out their differences without the rest of us looking in like it's some kind of science experiment, you know. So, let's just move on and wish them the best, you know. So what you're ultimately doing by not using people's vulnerabilities against them is you're creating an atmosphere where people can actually admit that they need clarity, help, extra time, extra planning, or additional training. And so they don't have to hide these things and then cause elements of the task they're in charge of not to get done because they're afraid of admitting they need help.
Yeah, you want to encourage openness, I guess.
Exactly. And then the last two are pretty simple. Is almost all of these techniques that we've been talking about, all of these steps we've been talking about, are about considering individual and group needs simultaneously. Because each affects the other. If an individual is apathetic or agitated or feels scared or becomes secretive because their vulnerabilities are used against them, that affects the ability of the entire group to function. But at the same time, when everybody feels like they're out for themselves and their needs aren't being met, then that affects the ability of the group to get things done. So they're all interconnected. So you might as well just deal with them.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't separate them at all. No, you're right.
And then finally, number 16 here is the culmination is by appreciating the symphony of everything that was going on there and following these steps, you will become the conductor, whether you're the perceived leader or not.
Yeah, you will become the leader through managing the emotions of others and helping direct them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so that's very good. So I'm wondering whether you could perhaps, from your experience, just give us a couple of examples where some of the things that we've spoken about today have sort of taken place and you've been able to facilitate a turnaround or you've witnessed it or something. Obviously, you can't go into too much detail, but I'm sure you can talk in broad terms about some examples you've seen.
Oh, one thing I see often is an interpersonal difficulty between two team members affecting a group. And so when that happens, you first of all have to notice. You have to show up and you feel like something's off in the group. And if I've done a body scan before I walk into the room, and I feel pretty calm and optimistic, and I walk into the room and then my energy drops and I feel tension in my body, the first thing I'm going to do is begin to breathe into that, knowing that there's something going on in the room. It's either related to someone's personal life or it's some kind of interpersonal difficulty. Or it might be one of those, the management never listens to us, which is kind of like a group interpersonal difficulty between your team and the management. and so, yeah, I would just sit there and I'm watching people and breathing into the tension because that allows everybody to relax a little bit. And then as we start talking about what's going on and people achieving the goal, I might see Karen rolling her eyes at Steve, who then looks away whenever Ingrid talks. So now I'm looking at three things going on here. Somehow, Karen, Steve, and Ingrid either have something going on between all three of them, or it's an individual interpersonal difficulty between Steve and Ingrid and Karen and Steve. And so I'm just watching them and seeing what's happening. And I can pretty much tell that no one in this group is dealing with a personal at home incongruence because of their body languages related to each other at all times. So it's not like Karen is just upset with something at home. It's every time Steve talks, she rolls her eyes, you know? And so I can see what's going on, and maybe I can't get enough information in the meeting for that to be brought out in the meeting. Because usually it's too hard for people to admit an interpersonal difficulty in a group meeting. So what I might do instead is decide to have three different separate 20-minute meetings with Karen, Steve, and Ingrid to catch up on what's going on. And then a lot of times when you have a meeting with someone to say, is there anything happening in the group or training-wise that's keeping you from getting your job done? You know, and a lot of times people will, in a private meeting to me, admit who is driving them crazy. So I don't really have that much trouble getting it out of people if I'm actively involved in the group because of the other 16 elements that I'm interacting with here, that I don't use people's vulnerabilities against them, that I do emphasize that interpersonal difficulties will be handled privately first with my full support. And so quite often they just admit what's going on. And then we get each of them to prepare a difficult conversation form, which is one of the later guiding principles. And then through that process, we begin to work out what's going on. And I've seen really intense things that looked like people weren't going to be able to work together turn around just through this engagement. And in terms of management never listens to us, when we do some troubleshooting and get the entire group to work on this difficult conversation form, and then I'm going to present it to them, then things can change. Because if I'm not triggered by what the group is feeling, and I'm not triggered by what management is feeling, if I'm really willing to find out, how does the group contribute to the management not listening to them? If I'm open to that idea, and then I'm open to the idea of management doesn't listen to the group, it's a waste of their time and money. They really should want to work through this. And if not, I'm just not sure what our entire division is doing there, because it's just a waste of money. You know, there's just ways that through all of this gathering of information, not using inflammatory words and phrases, and having everyone's best interest at heart, things turn around really efficiently.
And you've witnessed that in maybe companies you've gone into, as opposed to in sort of the operations that you've worked in.
Yes, most of the companies I've worked with want to do at most like a day and a half of training. And so I don't get to give them the advanced skills because they want to learn some emotional and social intelligence skills working with horses. And so I give them as much information as I can, and then they just move forward. And I can see that they haven't gotten all the skills they need to really take it to the next level, which is why I'm writing this book.
Yeah, and we're doing this symposium.
Yes.
Indeed. Okay, well, that's great. Thank you for all of that. I just love the practical nature of it. And as I say, what comes out as we go through it is some of these ideas that spring to mind to me, because I'm the dummy here, or the student, should I say.
I think a student, but you're no dummy.
I'm working on the dummy bit. I think, let's say, just going in, as you said, and sensing what's going on, and learning to be aware of it, and breathing through those difficulties is just a really good intro to it. And as you say, that in itself will probably start to change the dynamic of meetings. And I was thinking, you know, if you were to have, in some of the meetings I've been in, if there was to be a £1,000 stallion in some of the meetings I've been in, gee, that horse would have been through the wall, I would think. So I guess you can kind of imagine the same thing is if you were trying to be that horse and trying to sort of compute or the emotions and the feelings that were running wild within the room there. I'm sure if the horse can do it, then we can surely do it.
Absolutely.
And then learn to be able to control them.
And I think that if we have a cathedral thinking point of view on this, which is that the change is going to happen over time, you can't just show up in a dysfunctional group and turn it around for the good forever in one meeting. It's a combination of people seeing over time that what you can do is comforting and helpful and affects their bottom line in a positive way, they're going to be more inclined to follow you. And then as you rise up and ask for training for these skills for everybody in the group, then the entire group elevates. That just takes time. But you have to start somewhere, and this is a good place to start.
That's great. Okay, well, that's fantastic. Thanks very much for all your time today. Tell us, what's coming up in Chapter 4 and Guiding Principle 4?
Well, Guiding Principle 4 is about using the concept of crescendoing or turning up your power and following that up immediately with immediate positive feedback. We're going to talk about that in terms of setting boundaries and also in terms of motivating others to perform a task. And I know we've talked about that a little bit, but we're going to get more specific about it in the next lesson. In Chapter 4, we're looking at George Washington at a more intimate level as he came into power and some of the extraordinary things he was able to do that really were effective that we can learn from and that can inspire us when we're in tense situations, realizing that no matter what we're facing in a business meeting or a family meeting, chances are we're not seeing 2,000 men die around us at Valley Forge and managing to stay heroic and effective in that situation. So
he was quite the hero, wasn't he?
He was. He wasn't perfect. That's what I like about him, too. He was learning. He was on a learning curve, and he always learned. and did some amazing things. So we can all use him as a great role model because he wasn't perfect.
Yeah, the perennial student, as we should all be.
Yes.
Okay, Linda, thank you very much, and we shall speak again next time.
Thank you, Mark.